From PRI, Public Radio International, it's To the Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Jim Fleming. We're going to the movies today. We'll find out how the Star Machine manufactured movie stars back in the day. Also, we'll discover why the Coen brothers' film The Big Lebowski became a huge cult favorite. And we'll look at how independent screenplays work.
There's an old joke. Two elderly women are at a Catskill Mountain resort, and one of them says, "Boy, the food at this place is really terrible." The other one says, "Yeah, I know, and such small portions." Well, that's essentially how I feel about life, full of loneliness and misery and suffering and unhappiness, and it's all over much too quickly. The other important joke for me is one that's usually attributed to Groucho Marx, but I think it appears originally in Freud's Wit and Its Relation to the Unconscious. And it goes like this, I'm paraphrasing. I would never want to belong to any club that would have someone like me for a member. That's the key joke of my adult life in terms of my relationships with women.
That is a clip from Woody Allen's 1977 Academy Award-winning comedy, Annie Hall. Woody Allen, of course, is one of the great comedians and filmmakers of our time. Allen is notoriously media shy, yet Eric Lax has had regular conversations with him over the past 36 years. Lax has turned these conversations into a book called Conversations with Woody Allen, His Films, the Movies, and Movie Making. Eric Lax had a conversation with Steve Paulson about Woody Allen. Lax also shared, only with To the Best of Our Knowledge, a few exclusive clips of Allen's comments. Lax told Steve that Woody Allen used to feel limited when writing screenplays. He'd never write anything that he himself couldn't perform.
It's fascinating to think about that because we mainly know Woody Allen, I think, for the comic persona that he has created in his movies. I mean, being an actor, I mean, yes, we certainly know him as a director as well, but I mean, the most obvious way we know him as an actor. And then in the interviews you've done with him, he is remarkably dismissive of his own acting abilities. He calls himself a silly comic who plays for laughs and says he has a minuscule acting range, and he talks about quitting acting. And I want to play an excerpt from one of the interviews that you did with him when you ask him if he'll miss acting.
Miss acting? No. No, I don't, because I don't miss it when I don't do it. And there have been times I've gone a couple of pictures.
Yeah.
A couple of pictures is a couple of years.
Yeah, I know.
No, it doesn't mean anything.
There's no sense of, well, you know, that's end of that chapter. We'll go on to the next one.
You know, I've been in films my whole adult life, yeah, almost. And I don't think there's anything about it that I would miss. I'm happy to do it, but I don't, you know, if tomorrow I couldn't get financing,
right,
you know, I'm very happy to write plays. I'm very happy to sit home and try and write a book, maybe to write an autobiography or a memoir or something. Just, you know, I just like to work.
I have to say, this is a remarkably unromantic view of a life in the movies. You get a sense that Woody sees himself as just a working stiff from Brooklyn who happened to fall into a nice career in the movies. And okay, sure, if he's going to give up his acting gig, that's fine.
Yeah, I think there's a certain truth to that. I think the other part of it is he has a capacity, I think, unlike anybody else I know, to have so many different ideas going on in his head at once that he can choose from to do, that it's not a sense for him of, oh my goodness, if I'm not allowed to do this, what am I going to do? It's, if I can't do this, then I'll do that. The other thing that he's done is that from the start, he was a very successful, starting at 16, writing jokes for Broadway columnists. He was well paid for his sense of humor, and he knew early on that he could make people laugh, and he saw his comedy, once he started to make films, as a way to get into the film business. But always, even before he started making movies, he loved drama more than he loved comedy. He always thought that he talks a lot in the book about how, for him, it's just more satisfying. And so he thought that by getting a good foothold as a comic, he would then have the freedom or the space to be able to start doing dramas. And he found, a bit to his surprise, that when he tried early on, the audience and the critics didn't necessarily come with them. Interiors, for instance, or Stardust Memories. Movies that in retrospect I think are much better as they were when they were received, except by a few people.
These were his serious movies, which were a huge departure from the better-known comedies like Annie Hall and Manhattan.
Right, or even Take the Money and Run, which is just nothing but a series of gags really strung together. For him, though, it's that he once said, you know, you have to present a moving target. There's a trap. He said, people will say to you, oh, we love the comedies. Just do what you've been doing. And people will go along with that for some period of time, and then one day you'll come out with the very thing that they've always wanted you to do and have appreciated. And they say, oh, it's the same old thing. Who wants to go see that? Why doesn't he do something else? I'm so tired of this. And so he knew that rather than face that, it was better for him to say, I'm tired of this. I want to try something else. And people could come or not. He quotes a thing from Richard Schickel, the Time magazine film critic and also the wonderful biographer of several subjects, where Schickel said that at one point along the line, Woody's audience left him. And Woody said, you know, it was very nice of him to do that. But the truth is, he said, I think I left my audience. When I started to do things that were outside of the realm of what they had expected, then I lost some people along the line. And I think it was not really until Match Point a couple of years ago that he was able to do a drama that was both satisfying to himself and also to really a broad audience. And it's proved in that case by this was far and away the most financially successful film that he's ever made. Here's a murder story that he's not in, a very dark story, and it did almost $100 million worldwide.
I want to pick up this idea about Woody kind of resenting being pigeonholed as a filmmaker of comedies, because that came up in this interview that you did with him. And I want to play another excerpt, and this is, I think, right after he made his film Scoop. He makes the suggestion that he's had a wasted career.
You know, when I finished Scoop, I thought to myself, you know, what a nuisance. I mean, I'm wasting my time with this little comedy. And I could have been doing, you know, another piece of work like Match Point or a significant, you know, a more meaty thing. What am I wasting my time with this? Now, I wish I had come to this conclusion 25 years ago, but I did. And I don't know that I could have implemented it then easily because there was a fierce pressure on me from many people to do comedy.
So what do you make of Woody Allen's put-downs of his own comedies? I mean, these are the movies that made him famous.
Right. You have to read kind of between the lines here. I don't think he wants to disown those films in any way. He says, you know, people think that I hate comedy or that I denigrate. He says, it's not that. He said, look, I would be stupid if I said anything other than this, is that I've had a wonderful career from it. I've made a lot of money from it. I've made many people happy by what I've done. And I've made some very satisfactory films of that. He said, but in the end, that's not all I wanted to do. That as he started out in his artistic career, he saw himself being earlier in life than he is. He's in his 70s now. He saw himself in his being able in his 30s or his 40s to be able to make the switch to drama. And he found that for a number of reasons that didn't work. It wasn't a case of him saying, oh, I'm going to go back and make these films that I hate, because that wasn't the case at all. That it was, he just was unable to grow in the way that he most wanted.
And yet the other side of that is that if you were to ask most people what the most memorable Woody Allen movies were, I'm sure they would go back to Annie Hall and Manhattan. I mean, these films that seem to express the zeitgeist of that time, of the late 70s, when Woody Allen really was in the center of the world. And I mean, most people would see him as being now a relatively marginal figure in the movie world. And yet he himself doesn't even seem to value those particular movies that highly. He has other movies of his that he likes much more.
Yes, what's so funny about those two films is that in the case of Manhattan, right up to the time it was released, he wanted to buy it back from United Artists and redo it. And in Annie Hall was a far cry from the movie that he envisioned. The film was originally called Anhedonia, the inability to derive pleasure. And it was a much more kind of stream of consciousness interior monologue of a guy played by Woody and the problems that he would have in that. But as he would put it together and was doing it, even Marshall Brickman, who co-wrote it with him, said, you know, I can't follow this story. And, you know, and as Woody said, he's the co-writer of it. But he said what people did find when he was the few people who were watching it is they became very interested in the story of Alvy and Annie. And so that Keaton-Woody relationship became more and more the film, and that's really how it became. That's not how it started out. That's just how it ended up. It was one of the great things about filmmaking, of course, is how much is done in the editing room and what you're able to do when you go back and reshoot.
Now, the other thing that comes out in these interviews that you've done with Woody Allen is he seems to be, in real life, not at all the person who he projects in his screen roles. I mean, he's obviously a very funny guy when he's on stage, but when, you know, he's not in front of a camera, he's quite a serious guy and clearly a workaholic.
Yes, clearly a workaholic. I mean, the problem with Woody in terms of people confusing his persona, who they see on film, and him in real life, is that the two people dress exactly the same and talk exactly the same. So it's hard to differentiate them. But as he points out, he says, I didn't make this character. He said, I wrote a character that, as people came to accept, he said, I saw what worked, and that character came out of what worked. And so he knows how to play that character, he knows how to talk like it, he knows the timing and the cadence and the delivery for that person. But in real life, if he were a director or a writer or an artist who was as in such turmoil and panic as that character, and kind of so out of control of all these things that affect him, he would never be able to get these films out. What you realize is that in real life, he's somebody who has really total control over virtually every aspect of what he does. He has had from the start something almost unheard of in filmmaking, is that he has complete control over the movie.
Well, I want to play one more excerpt from this interview you did back in 2006, where he talks about the downside of making movies, which is marketing.
You know, you can't just give them the film and leave them holding the bag. You got to help a little bit. So promotion usually entails, you know, traveling places and answering questions and being interviewed and trying to tell people how great your film is without seeming to say it's great, you know, which is just so silly. And it never means anything, you know. And raising money and sitting with people who want to do ads that appeal to the lowest common denominator when you want your ad. You know, there's nothing really to miss.
It's enough to swear off movie making forever.
Well, it is, you know, and that for him is that in the end, his feeling is that a good film will draw its audience, and that word of mouth has a great deal to do with it. What's been astonishing to watch over these years, I mean, one of the real pleasures of this book for me, and I like to think for him in some way too, is that most times when you're writing about somebody, even when they're trying to do a summary of their lives, they're talking from a specific point of view. It's a snapshot from them at 60 or 70 or 80 or whatever it is. And what we see here with him over the years is this is like a family album. You see him in his 30s all the way into his 70s talking about what goes on. And he's been consistent in this all the way through. And part of the reason that he so dislikes having to go out and promote them is, A, he doesn't think it does a lot of good. But even more than that, it's that by the time the film is released, he is well into the next one. Truthfully, the day that he finishes editing a film, while he's even editing it, he's already on to the next one. So by the time that film comes out, he's ready to start shooting the next.
Now, Woody Allen has a strange combination of qualities. On the one hand, he's very self-confident about what he does. I mean, there's a sense that he really doesn't care that much about what critics say. You know, they've been blasting him for years now. Mm-hmm. And yet, on the other hand, he is totally dismissive, at least the way he presents himself in these interviews, as his significance artistically. I mean, he says he's had no impact on younger filmmakers, which I simply don't believe, and he claims that he has not achieved anything significant artistically.
Right, and he says, look, the only thing standing between me and a great film is me.
Eric Lax is the author of Conversations with Woody Allen, His Films, the Movies, and Movie Making. He spoke with Steve Paulson. Our thanks to Lax and Allen for giving us permission to air a few excerpts from their conversations. What's your favorite Woody Allen film? You can send us email through our website at ttbook.org. Coming up, we'll explore the golden age of Hollywood and find out how the star machine manufactured gods and goddesses for the silver screen as we continue our focus on film. I'm Jim Fleming. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from PRI, Public Radio International. Janine Basinger is the chair of film studies at Wesleyan University and curator of the cinema archives there. Basinger's written 10 books on film, including her latest, The Star Machine. It explores how the movie studios manufactured stars from the 1930s to the 1950s. Janine Basinger told Anne Strainchamps how the Star Machine transformed Tyrone Power.
First of all, Tyrone Power came from a very respected and successful theatrical family. His father, Tyrone Power Sr., was a distinguished actor, and he grew up around theater. So he was not, you know, somebody plucked out of a gas station, you know? I mean, he wasn't somebody drove up to get gas and said, whoa, this guy is cute. You know, he's a different kettle of fish. But he was an extremely beautiful young man, very good looking. And he also had a lovely voice that could be well recorded. When he first came out to Hollywood, he didn't quite catch on. It didn't quite work. And in a screen test that he had made, Daryl Zanuck's wife allegedly said, you know, you have to pluck his eyebrows. You have to pluck his eyebrows. Presumably, a pair of tweezers made all the difference in his life. But, you know, when you think about the camera coming in close on someone, eyebrows can make a difference between somebody looking like a villain and somebody looking gorgeous. And he really was gorgeous. The minute they started putting him in a tuxedo and into a minor film to be amongst the beautiful women that they were developing, he looked right.
Oh, you have a funny story about, I think, one of the first films like that he did. He has a single line. He just walks up to the girl and says, yes, may I have this dance? And,
yes.
And everyone in the audience said, yes.
Yes, exactly. And they all started writing in and saying, who's the guy in the tuxedo and when do we see him again? They definitely were going to give him the dance. And in fact, they did give him the dance. He was a top box office star. And he really was one of Hollywood's most beautiful leading men. The tragedy for him is he really was a fine actor, and he understood good acting, but Hollywood understood his beauty. And although he always gave good performances, he wanted to be taken seriously. He wanted serious roles. Hollywood preferred to put him in a tuxedo and let him be a leading man in a romantic comedy or a swashbuckling drama. So for him, the system became ultimately stultifying, a kind of limitation, although he did get serious roles, of course.
Mm. You write that at his peak in some of the films that were really vehicles for him, the camera used to linger on Tyrone Power in a way usually reserved for female stars.
It's sometimes, I think, forgotten that men were subjected to the same kind of ogling camera angles and shots that women were. Men also had to pose for their equivalent of cheesecake photos, known as beefcake photos. Men had to get in bathing suits and pose on diving boards. Men had to, you know, be lingered over. And the thing is, because Hollywood was selling both male and female glamour, it was selling sex objects, both male and female. And Tyrone Power is a really good example of a really beautiful young man. No matter who was his leading lady, he was probably the most beautiful person in the frame. He would lean back on pillows and the camera hover over him in real close-ups. Sometimes he would just be sitting at a table in a nightclub, smoking, watching the dancing, and the camera would just sit there and look at him.
Do you have a favorite Tyrone Power film and scene?
I'm really fond of a serious role he played later, Witness for the Prosecution, a Billy Wilder film. He's terrific in that.
What are you looking for?
My accordion.
Oh, let me help you. I think I found it.
Step on it again. It's still breathing.
I'm terribly sorry.
You better get out of here. We've had trouble enough.
Well, actually, it's your own fault. That costume in the picture outside gave the boys ideas, and then those trousers of yours let them down hard.
What's his best scene in that film?
It's the one where he finally reveals who he truly is. It's a secret. If I give it away, I'll ruin the movie for anybody who hasn't seen it. It's the last scene, folks.
The management of this theater suggests that for the greater entertainment of your friends who have not yet seen the picture, you will not divulge to anyone the secret of the ending of Witness for the Prosecution.
What about some of the big female stars? How did the star system treat them? Lana Turner, for instance, who was at one point romantically involved with Tyrone Power. How did the star machine treat her?
Well, Lana Turner is just a great example of typical, well, untypical, because she's too glamorous to be ever called typical. Lana Turner couldn't be typical anything, but she is an example of a star created by the system. And her legend is sort of the one that is basic and fundamental to people's mythology of stardom, discovered sitting on a soda fountain stool, you know, that kind of thing. That is her story. Of course, it's not exactly true, but that's what makes it all the better. But she really, of course, came into it so young without much education, and she grew up in the glamour factory. Didn't have a chance to get a lot of education or learn how to take care of herself. She was out there nightclubbing, having a good time, and thus life kind of slopped over into her film career. She became notorious, the queen of the nightclubs. And then through a series of kind of sad and tragic cases, namely the murder of one of her lovers or whatever you want to call it. I don't know if you call it a murder. When her daughter stabbed one of her lovers in what she felt was defending her mother, Lana Turner became notorious and got locked into a kind of image that was limiting for her.
A sort of bad girl image, but then that became part of her role on screen too, right?
Her private life began to define her persona. Most stars have their personas defined by the roles they play on screen, and people decide that's who they are. As Cary Grant famously said, everybody wants to be Cary Grant. I would like to be Cary Grant, meaning this very calm, very self-confident, fabulous image that he had honed wasn't who he really was in private life. Who Lana Turner was in private life, the sort of queen of the nightclubs with many lovers and a kind of wild life, sexy life, began to inform who she could play on screen because that's how people saw her. As her career advanced, it started to move into the time where stars were less protected in their private lives than they were during the heyday of the system. So people began to know who the stars were off screen, in a way that was not controlled by the publicity machine. So she kind of came into a more modern era where, you know, you couldn't hide things anymore in quite the same way.
Did the studio executives decide consciously to take advantage of her bad girl persona in real life and to use that on screen?
I think that they were stuck. I think that yes, yes, and no. I think that they made an attempt when they put her in a couple of musicals to do something a little bit different with her, but they were aware that the public saw her a certain way, and that was the business they were in, selling the product, making the public believe the product was who the role was on screen. So once that element entered in, they worked with it. So she kind of became a real victim of her own fame, her own notoriety. But you know, she lived a long life and she died a wealthy woman. She wasn't found playing bit parts or, you know, living on the dole somewhere. So she did survive it in her own way. Whatever pain she suffered was the pain she suffered, of course.
Is there a definitive Lana Turner performance, one that you think really captures what made her such a great star?
I think that if you look at Lana Turner in The Bad and the Beautiful, a story of a woman who comes into stardom and how that happens. You are looking at the definitive Lana Turner performances. That one, she plays a movie star, and that is a role she understands. She plays a woman who is shaped into stardom, and she understands the process, she understands the challenge, she understands the pressure. That is probably her greatest actual acting screen performance.
Mr. Shields, you have a very stubborn hand.
Very, when I'm right. And I know I'm right about you. I gave you no help. The test was atrocious. But bad as it was, it proved one thing. When you're on the screen, no matter who you're with, what you're doing, the audience is looking at you. That star quality.
Jeanine Basinger is the author of The Star Machine. She spoke with N. Strange Champs. Do you have favorite movie stars from Hollywood's golden age? How do you think today's film stars compare to them? You can share your thoughts by sending us email through our website at ttbook.org. It's always nice to hear from you. Coming up, we'll find out what makes independent film screenplays different from mainstream Hollywood screenplays. And we'll find out how a 1998 Coen Brothers film really ties a devoted group of fans together. I'm Jim Fleming. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from PRI, Public Radio International. J.J. Murphy is a filmmaker and a film professor at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. He's also the author of Me and You and Memento and Fargo, How Independent Screenplays Work. In the book, Murphy argues that the independent feature film from the 1980s to today has developed its own distinct approach to cinematic storytelling. J.J. Murphy talked about this different approach with Steve Paulson, beginning with Ethan and Joel Coen's 1996 Academy Award-winning movie, Fargo.
I think what makes Fargo different is it has to do with the protagonist of the film. And that's one of the ways that I think that independent films are different. So in classical Hollywood film, you have this notion of the goal-driven protagonist. And so I wanted to look at other possibilities of protagonists. What happens if your protagonist is passive or ambivalent? In this case, it really led to a question, who is the protagonist of Fargo? And most people say Marge is the protagonist of the film.
She's the detective played by Frances McDormand.
Exactly. But she isn't introduced in the film until 33 minutes into the film. And so it's quite unusual to have your protagonist introduced so late into a film. She really doesn't have the dramatic conflict either.
So what you're saying is that the film started one way where we think, oh, the main character is maybe Jerry, the mm-hmm. guy who's setting up this fake kidnapping so that right. he can collect the ransom for his wife who's been kidnapped. But then maybe he's not the main character after all.
I think what happens in the course of Fargo is that the protagonist shifts from Jerry to Marge, and that's somewhat unusual for a film. And some manuals claim it's not possible because they'll say that the protagonist has to be introduced in the first 10 minutes of the film. And, well, Fargo is an example where that just isn't the case. And yet, it's a widely acclaimed film and people think it's a great film.
And I'm sure the thinking is that the audience has to be able to identify with this main character from the get-go.
Exactly. And I think it would have been possible for the Coen brothers to introduce Marge very early into the film. We could have had her introduced in the first 10 minutes of the film, and then once the murders are committed, she would come in. But that's not what they choose to do.
So you're saying that Fargo is an example of a film that really subverts the traditional movie structure, but it totally works.
Exactly.
Now, there's another scene in Fargo that's kind of curious. Marge, the detective, meets a former classmate at the Radisson Inn in the Twin Cities, and it seems to have nothing to do with the rest of the story. Tell me about that scene.
Oh, it's a great scene. What happens is that Marge is going to bed one night and she gets a phone call from Mike Yanagita, a former classmate. And Mike has seen her on television in connection with the murders. And he asks to meet her at the Radisson Inn in Minneapolis. And what's interesting is that Marge goes to Minneapolis ostensibly to try to gather information about the crime, but she does meet Mike, and she doesn't tell her husband. And in fact, it's the only time when we see her really dressed up in the film. And so she comes in to meet Mike Yanagita, and he wants to sit close to her, and she's very tactful in how she is able to hold her own.
Linda had leukemia, you know. She passed away.
No.
It was tough. There you go. It was long. She fought real hard, Marge. You know, that's what can you say? Oh, better times, huh?
Better times.
Oh, and then I saw you on the TV, and I remembered, you know, I always liked you.
Well, I always liked you,
I always liked you so much.
So, Mike, should we get together another time, you think?
No, I'm sorry. It's, you know, I shouldn't have done this. I thought we'd have a really terrific time.
It's okay, Mike.
You were such a super lady. And then I've been so lonely.
It's okay, Mike.
What's interesting about that scene is, why is that scene there? It doesn't advance the plot in any sort of way. So it's really there to develop Marge's character. And I think without that scene, it would be a hard case to make that Marge becomes the protagonist of the film. But it's a scene that allows us to believe that. And I think the scene is important because it shows that even Marge, who seems happy, she's pregnant, she's happily married to Norm, that even she is somehow susceptible to, you know, these other forces. And I think that that's how it plays in the film. And of course, the other thing I should mention is he tells her that his wife has died, and she finds out subsequently that he's been lying to her. And I think that that lie has more of an effect than the actual murders that she's been investigating. And that is interesting in terms of her character.
Well, let's talk about a more recent film that got a lot of acclaim when it came out, Memento, the 2001 neo-noir film, which is, it's about a guy who has lost his memory, or his very short-term memory, can't sort of remember anything for a long time. And it's a mystery story. You call it a puzzle film.
Mm-hmm. Yes, I call it a puzzle film because it's a film that is really hard to figure out, especially on one viewing. And I think the attraction of puzzle films, I should jump back a little bit. That was a film that played at Sundance. It did not get distribution. The reason it didn't get distribution was because the distributors thought that nobody would understand the film, that it was too difficult to understand.
And part of the reason why it's so difficult is it's not told in with linear narration. It jumps around in time.
Exactly. Well, it goes, a lot of people always say that it goes backwards, but part of it goes backwards and part of it goes forwards, and then it kind of loops around. So it has this very unusual structure. But I think that if you watch the film at least the second time, the film does make sense, and it's a very interesting film for a lot of reasons. One is because the film really puts you into the mind of Leonard Shelby, the protagonist, and you experience the film through his eyes. And so he can't remember, and so that's the way that you apprehend the film as well.
And there's this basic question about the film. I mean, is Leonard the main character? Is he basically a good guy out to avenge the murder of his wife, or is he a homicidal killer himself?
Exactly. But I think that the structure of the film at least gives us the sense when we're watching it that he is a good person and that he is He is trying to avenge the murder of his wife.
You're gonna pay for what you did. Beg forgiveness, and then you pay.
Let it. You're a clue, you freak.
Beg my wife's forgiveness before I blow your brains out.
Leonard, you don't know what's going on. You don't know who you are.
I'm Leonard Shelby. I'm from San Francisco.
That's who you were. That's not what you become.
Shut your mouth.
You want to know, Lenny? Come on. Come on, let's go down to the basement. Let's go down, you and me, together. Then you'll know who you really are. No!
I think without that structure, it would be a very different kind of film and a very different kind of experience. And we as an audience wouldn't be able to identify with Leonard in the same way. I think we need to believe, like Leonard, that he's a victim rather than the perpetrator of, you know, homicidal crimes.
So you're saying this movie would not have worked if it was just told in a straightforward narrative?
I've actually watched it the other way. On the DVD, there's a special way you can actually watch the film in reverse, in linear fashion, and it's quite a different experience. And to me, it doesn't work nearly as well.
So what have the filmmakers said about that, why they wanted to construct the film with this unusual narrative structure?
Well, again, I think that one of the things that independent filmmakers are always trying to do is to differentiate their films from mainstream films. And I think that novelty and originality are really important in screenplays. And so if you have everybody is insisting that screenplays have to have certain conventions and follow certain rules and have to have turning points on certain pages. What happens is that you don't get that same sense of originality. I find it very inhibiting for screenwriters who are trying to learn because they're told you can't do this, you can't do that, you have to do this. And really, that's not the way creativity works. And so that's one of the things I hope to do with this book is to open up that process to show that, in fact, there are many more possibilities to how to create screenplays than the way that we're told.
Now, in some ways, these issues that you've been talking about, sort of this classical structure that you're supposed to use to create a screenplay, was the subject of a movie a few years ago, Adaptation, the Charlie Kaufman screenplay, where, I mean, it turns on this screenwriter who is blocked, and then he's got this brother who goes off
right.
to a course, and he sits at the feet of a noted screenwriting coach.
Yes, he does, and there's very funny lines in Adaptation, and they seem to be parodying the manual approach, and in fact, those are actually the first couple of sentences in a particular screenwriting manual.
So there's a real manual there, and isn't the person they're talking about, isn't that a real screenwriting coach?
Yes, absolutely. He's a screenwriting guru.
Easy answers, rules to shortcut yourself to success, and here I am, because my jaunt into the abyss brought me nothing. Well, isn't that just the risk one takes for attempting something new? I should leave here right now. I'll start over. I need to face this project head on.
And God help you if you use voiceover in your work, my friends. God help you. It's flaccid, sloppy writing. Any idiot can write voiceover narration to explain the thoughts of a character. Okay, that's it. 1 hour for lunch.
Funny thing about that movie is in some ways it seemed like such an independent film, but it had big Hollywood stars, Meryl Streep and other people.
Well, some people say that Charlie Kaufman is the only screenwriter who's allowed to do what he wants. You only allow one. That's why you have to create other alternatives through independent films because the industry only has room for one.
There are no rules, Donald. And anybody who says there are
not rules. Principles. McKee writes that a rule says you must do it this way. A principle says this works and has through all remembered time.
The script I'm starting, it's about flowers.
Oh.
Nobody's ever done a movie about flowers before. So there are no guidelines.
What about Flowers for Algernon?
Well, that's not about flowers.
It's
not a movie.
I'm sorry, I never saw it. Okay, keep going.
Look, my point is that those teachers are dangerous if your goal is to try to do something new. And a writer should always have that goal. Writing is a journey into the unknown. It's not
building, you know, one of your model airplanes.
J.J. Murphy is a filmmaker, film professor, and the author of Me and You and Memento and Fargo, How Independent Screenplays Work. He spoke with Steve Paulson. For some people, Ethan and Joel Coen's 1998 comedy The Big Lebowski is just a movie. But for achievers like Will Russell and Scott Shuffett, The Big Lebowski is the movie. Russell and Shuffett are the founders of Lebowski Fest, an annual event that celebrates The Big Lebowski. They're also the co-authors, along with Bill Green and Ben Pesco, of a book called I'm a Lebowski, You're a Lebowski, Life, The Big Lebowski, and what have you. As Will Russell and Scott Shuffett explain, the inspiration for Lebowski Fest has an appropriately Lebowski-esque flavor to it.
Scott and I were actually selling some T-shirts at this kind of mediocre tattoo convention, and we're out of our element. You know, we're just like, we don't get it. Why is this a convention? Why are these people here? And we were quoting lines, and some fellow vendors joined in with us, and we kind of had this instant bond, and we realized we were not alone in our obsession with The Big Lebowski. And we thought, you know, if they can have this tattoo convention, why can't we have a Big Lebowski convention? And then we just gave it a shot, just kind of as a joke, and we're still rolling.
Can you give me an example? I mean, the two of you obviously have enough of this movie in your heads that you can do it. Do you remember what lines you were throwing back and forth?
It's hard to say. It was probably, you know, the easier ones, you know, the do-to-bads. And Will, you're out of your element at this tattoo convention.
I can get you a toe.
This aggression will not stand.
There are ways, dude. I think it was Saturday, and we were talking about how it was Shabbos.
Somewhere Shabbos.
We couldn't roll on Saturday.
Yeah.
It's a Jewish day of rest.
The dude abides. He peed on my rug.
He peed on the dude's rug.
Donnie, you're out of your element, dude.
No, I do mind. The dude minds. This will not stand, you know? This aggression will not stand, man. I mean, it really tied the room together.
This was a value, dog.
Yeah. What tied the room together, dude?
My rug.
I don't roll on Shabbos.
Mark at 8, dude.
I'm Shomer Shabbos.
You're lucky they left the tape deck, though, in the credence.
Shomer Shabbos!
People who haven't seen the film are not going to know what you're talking about, but people
yes,
who have.
We sound insane. In fact, my girlfriend, whenever I'm quoting lines, like, she doesn't know that I'm quoting a line from the movie, but if I ever sound incoherent or just kind of insane, she just assumes that I'm quoting a line from the movie.
Now, the dude abides. I mean, you can say that almost anywhere, but if you're a Lebowski fan, you know exactly what that means.
Oh, yeah.
Scott, do you remember the very first time you saw The Big Lebowski?
I didn't see it, you know, when it came out to the theater. I was a video watcher.
Well, you were joined by a lot of people, I'm told, who didn't see it when it came out.
That's what I've heard.
It flopped when it came out. You know, it didn't do well at the box office, which actually kind of put it right where it needed to become the kind of cult film that it has become. That's kind of one of the prerequisites of becoming a cult movie is you can't do well, you know, commercially, you know, when it first comes out.
Well, let's talk about that a little bit. Is there any way that you can, for those who haven't seen it, describe it?
I think Will does a way better job of describing it than I do.
Well, I mean, it's basically a case of mistaken identity, and there's some confusion between a millionaire named Jeffrey Lebowski and a deadbeat unemployed bum named Jeffrey Lebowski who refers to himself as the dude. And basically, some thugs come to collect a debt. They go to the wrong guy's house. They end up urinating on the dude's rug.
Not the rug, man.
Not on the rug. And the dude basically spends the rest of the movie trying to get his rug back.
What can I do for you, sir?
Well, sir, it's this rug I have. It really tied the room together.
You told Brandt on the phone, he told me. Where do I fit in?
Well, they were looking for you, these two guys.
Did I urinate on your rug?
You mean, did you personally come and pee on my rug?
Hello, do you speak English, sir? Parla usted inglés? I'll ask you again, did I urinate on your rug?
No, like I said, woo peed on my rug.
I just want to understand this, sir. Every time a rug is micturated upon in this fair city, I have to compensate the person?
Come on, man, I'm not trying to scam anybody here. You know,
well, the rug tied the room together.
It really did. But the thing is, you know, it kind of has this whodunit plot going on, and it's very complicated, and there's all this twists and turns, And I think when people first watch The Big Lebowski, they watch it like they watch any other movie where you're following the plot.
Yeah, they're trying to solve the case.
Yeah, and the plot is ultimately unsatisfying and ultimately unimportant. Even the Coen brothers said that in an interview. It's not about the story. That's just the framework in which these amazing characters and great dialogue and incredibly entertaining film kind of unfolds. So when you watch it the first time, you don't really focus on that kind of stuff. You watch the plot and it's kind of like, what was that about? Because I didn't necessarily enjoy it the first time I saw it. I thought it was okay. But the third time, and that this seems to be the general consensus, is when people are like, this is amazing. Mm-hmm. And that's when you really kind of let go of the plot and you really start to learn to appreciate it in the way that we've come to appreciate it.
Do you have any comments on what it feels like to have watched it the 33rd time?
33rd time was great.
Yeah, I mean, the 87th time has been my favorite. But it really blows me away that I can watch the same movie over and over again, and it still makes me so happy. Yeah. It makes me laugh out loud. And you know, I don't know how to explain that. It's just this amazing film that the Coen brothers did that just holds up so well. It just gets better and better. It's like a great rock and roll album. You know, you can always listen to whatever Led Zeppelin 4 or whatever. It still sounds good.
We should say you don't have any connection to the Coen brothers. This is not a...
No, they have steered clear of us entirely. In fact, when we asked them kind of permission to write this book, they responded with one line that says, "You have neither our blessing nor our curse." apparently they don't really care. I don't know.
But you did talk to some of the actors. You talked to John Turturro?
Yes. Oh, yeah.
We talked to Jeff Bridges. We talked to Julianne Moore. We talked to Philip Seymour Hoffman. And, we interviewed pretty much every actor in the film.
Do the actors agree on why they think The Big Lebowski has become such a cult favorite?
A lot of them brought up the dude and how likable the character of the dude is. Even though he's kind of a slacker and he's unemployed, he's very genuine and very cool and very laid back and just really appealing. We could use some more dudes out there.
Absolutely.
In the world. And what was interesting about John Goodman's interview specific was that he loves this movie, and like he was quoting lines with us, and like we were just freaking out, you know, because he'd be like, you know, he'd talk about the nine-toed woman line. He's like, that's just an amazing line of dialogue. Where else are you going to get a line like that? And he said that, you know, it's been his favorite movie. It's his favorite character he's ever played. And if he could do it all over again, he would do it in a minute.
That wasn't her toe, dude.
Yeah, the nail polish, Walter.
Fine, dude. As if it's impossible to get some nail polish, apply it to someone else's toe. I can get you a toe. Believe me. There are ways, dude. You don't want to know about it, believe me.
Yeah, but Walter.
Hell, I can get you a toe by 3 o'clock this afternoon with nail polish.
And wouldn't be in a world of pain.
He would not be in a world of pain.
You're entering a world of pain.
Walter, man.
You mark that frame in 8, you're entering a world of pain.
I'm not.
A world of pain.
Look, dude, this is your partner.
Because the whole world gone crazy!
You know, we started talking about this, and we sort of drifted away from it. You held the first Big Lebowski, what do you call it, the Big Lebowski What Have You Fest?
That was the name of the first event that we did. We've since changed it to just Lebowski Fest.
You're into the whole brevity thing.
Yeah. But
did you expect anybody to come?
We expected 25 or 30 people, you know, that we knew that we hung out with to show up. And, you know, and that was about it.
This was in Louisville.
Yes, it was.
2002?
It was in a very, kind of one of the more shady areas in Louisville.
A lot of strip clubs.
Yeah.
A lot of trailer parks and liquor stores. And
yeah. About this bowling center that we used was not a normal bowling alley. They only opened up for, like, special occasions. It was a Baptist-run bowling alley. It had about 20 lanes. I think 17 were operating the night that we were there. But they didn't allow cursing, and they didn't allow drinking of alcohol.
And so, we should say that anybody who has watched The Big Lebowski knows that those two things are essential to the film.
Yes.
Absolutely. And so when I think we had maybe 150 people that came out, and, you know, they came from Buffalo and Arizona, even though we couldn't curse, we couldn't recite the dialogue, and we couldn't enjoy any White Russians, everyone still had a really good time.
They went out and achieved anyway. The word got out. It's like, oh, there's this Big Lebowski fan festival going on, this event, and we were just amazed. And then the next year we decided to do another one. It was like, it was huge. And we went from 150 people to about 1,200 people.
Do either of you have favorite scenes? Is there, Will, what about you? Is there a favorite scene of the Big Lebowski?
I really like the scene where the dude is taking a bubble bath and the Nihilists burst into his house with their marmot. And he's like, hey, this is a private residence, man. And then they come in, they throw the marmot in the bathtub. And just like the way Bridges squeals during that is hilarious.
Fantastic.
You think we are kidding or making with the funny stuff?
Yeah. Because you think you haven't dreamed of Lebowski.
Yeah, we believe in nothing.
We believe in nothing, Lebowski, nothing.
I was just thinking about somebody who's never seen this movie saying, the scene where what?
Exactly.
Yeah, we have a word for them. It's amateurs, but... They can achieve it. Just,
that's right.
Just got to go out and get that movie.
Amateurs can become achievers.
Yes, absolutely.
It is possible. With very little effort, really.
It's amazing how little.
Just hit play on the DVD.
Are you going to find these guys? Or, you know, I mean, you got any promising leads? Or
leads? Yeah, sure. I'll just check with the boys down at the crime lab. They got four more detectives working on the case. They got us working in shifts. Leads.
Will Russell and Scott Shuffett are the co-authors of I'm a Lebowski, You're a Lebowski, Life, The Big Lebowski, and what have you. They're also the co-founders of Lebowski Fest. The clips really tied that interview together, didn't they? A Lebowski Fest will be held in Chicago, March 7th to 9th. You can find a link to the Lebowski Fest website on our website at ttbook.org. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Jim Fleming. If you'd like a copy of this hour, you can call the radio store at 1-800-747-7444 and ask for program number 217B. Talking Pictures. If you have questions or comments about the program, you can send us email through our website at ttbook.org. To the Best of Our Knowledge is produced at Wisconsin Public Radio. This program was produced by Doug Gordon, with help from Mary Lou Finnegan, Anne Strainchamps, Charles Monroe Kane, and Veronica Rickert. Our executive producer is Steve Paulson. Our technical director is Kirill Owen. You can stream To the Best of Our Knowledge on our website at ttbook.org, where you will also find a link to the weekly podcast.